Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Poison Pen interview series here. My name's Patrick. I'm the science fiction and fantasy selector. Barbara is currently out of town enjoying a much needed vacation. And I am very fortunate to interview one of my favorites authors I get to chat with almost every year. She is not only an award winner, she has created, she's an innovator, quite the leader in both mystery and urban fantasy, and talking to us about her 47th novel in her very prestigious career. I'm very lucky to talk with Charlaine Harris. Charlaine, welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
It's always great to come back to Poison Pen, whether I'm there really or there virtually.
You know, and we have such a nice clientele and so many great people watching from all across the world and the United States. You know, we're really lucky. I mean, I think we're really blessed to have our customers and the people who come and view us all over the place. This is really an exciting venture that we get to kind of put these up online and talk to people all throughout the United States. And today we're very lucky to talk about your newest book, All the Dead Shall Weep. And this is a fantastic book within the Denny Rose series. I am so thrilled and so excited about this book, and I can't wait for people to get their hands on it. Do you want to give us a little bit of an elevator pitch on what's happened and, you know, what's going to happen within All the Dead Shall Weep without spoiling too much?
I'll try. It's a book with a lot of action. Lisbeth and her husband Eli are living in Texoma because Eli is not persona non grata in the Holy Russian Empire, which is California, in case you didn't know that. But her sister comes to visit, her half-sister Felicia, and Felicia's boyfriend, who is also Eli's brother, Peter, and they come to spend some time with Lisbeth, the only vacation they can take as students. And Lisbeth is worried about it because she thinks, are they really going to have a good time? Do I have to entertain them? Do they want to go hunting with me? Do they want to do magic with Eli? What's going to happen?
Exactly. And so you start us off with one big happy family coming back together again for the first time in a really long time. And you give us a really wonderful sense of peace for Gunny Rose, for a little bit of a chance for her to heal a little bit after she's lost her child. Just the chance for a little bit of a breather. And you trick us.
Oh, you would think. You know something terrible's going to happen. It always does.
It always does. And, you know, it's funny because it's, you know, you've got two really quieter chapters, I would have to say, to catch us up with everything that happens. I think this is a book that's really great for jumping into the series if you haven't read any of the Gunny Rose series before, because of the fact that you do catch us up so nicely within the first couple chapters. Although I said that too, and The Serpent in Heaven, which we also have a few signed copies left if anybody wants to get their hands on it. So, I mean, you, even though you're so good at writing a series, you don't let a reader who jumps into the middle feel completely out of place and lost.
That's a two-sided sword. You want to explain enough to where, if it is a person's first chance to pick up one of your books, you don't want to alienate them by making it inexplicable. At the same time, I get irate letters from people who say, I've read all your books. Why do you have to keep telling me what happened in the last one?
Yeah.
You can't really please everyone. I do want to give enough background. to where people understand what, where the action in the book is coming from.
Exactly. You know, and the funny thing is that, like you said, some people love that, some people hate it. You can't please everybody. I would rather catch people up and get them back into the series. And then they'll go back and read the other four if they like what they've read. And how can you not like what you've written?
Oh, now that's a lovely thing to say. I wish everybody in the world felt that way.
Well, you know, you've got a really strong fan base. And one of the things that I really loved about your book is that you dedicate this book to your readers. And I think that that's really important. You're very grateful for the readership that you've had throughout the year.
Yeah, for sure. Without my readers, I would be nothing.
I wouldn't say that, but we certainly have helped kind of bring forward all of your characters, from Aurora Tea Garden and Harper to Gunny Rose and Sookie Stackhouse. I mean, you've given us some of the best characters in both mystery and urban fantasy, and you've always been an innovator within both genres. And that is incredible.
Thank you.
One of the things that I was thinking about before we started talking is the fact that you do seem to have the finger on the pulse of what's going to be popular coming on down the road. So you wrote Sookie Stackhouse because you wanted to know about a relationship between a regular person and a vampire. And then that exploded, you know, probably within 1 to 2 years of the time that you started the Sookie Stackhouse series. And now Westerns are really making a comeback, you know, from Longmire to Yosemite to these shows that really kind of are modern takes on the Western. And you started writing the Gunny Rose series about 2 years before that really repopped up. What was it about the Western that really drew you into wanting to write about the West, so to speak?
Well, I spent part of my childhood in Texas. Every summer, I would come stay at my grandparents' hotel. My mother would come with us and she would help them during the rodeo season. So I would get the chance to be exposed to a completely different culture. I was brought up in the Mississippi Delta, which could not be a more different setting than the West in the 1950s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And the contrast was really sharp. And for the first time, let me know that being brought up in the Mississippi Delta was not the be-all and end-all of existence.
Right.
So I got to experience that, and I always remembered what a shock it had been to me, what a difference it was. And I kind of wanted to talk about that, to go back there and talk about a woman who led a life that was so different from my ancestors. At least I think so. And then I had to build the world that would let her do what she was best at doing, mm-hmm. which was, you know, shooting lots of people. And yet I didn't want her to spend all her time in jail, you know. So it just kind of evolved around that to a world that would let her be who she was and we could see things through her eyes.
Exactly. And, you know, the female sharpshooter was, of course, I mean, I always think of Annie Oakley, the famous female sharpshooter, you know. Did you do any research on sharpshooting and female sharpshooters of the West before really getting into Gunny Rose as a character? Or what did you do to kind of immerse yourself into although it isn't, you know, the old West that we're thinking about. We're thinking more, you know, 1920s, 30s.
Yes, here. Yes. I had to do a lot more research than I usually do. I do know a guy who is an expert on weapons, and he was nice enough to answer some questions I asked. And then now on YouTube, I can watch people load and use even the oldest weapons, which is very instructive. So I had to learn a lot about guns. I had to learn a lot about what life was like in the 30s, even in a fractured America, there had to be some similarities to what America actually was in the 30s, like who had refrigerators, who had indoor toilets, what was the train system like? And luckily, it's easy to find a lot of materials still extant that deal with those subjects.
Exactly. And one of the pleasures of writing urban fantasy and writing the type of Gunny Rose series is everything. I mean, it's science fiction or an alternate history, really. And the fact is that, you know, the United States has been broken up and run by the part of it being run by the Holy Russian Empire. And what I really loved was that you could take parts of Texoma and you could, even bring it back a little bit as if it hasn't quite caught up to kind of the 1930s sort of standards. Although I'm wondering, I mean, probably there was quite a bit of Texas that hadn't been built up during that time period with the same infrastructure as probably the rest of the United States.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. I remember my dad talking about, he grew up in Estes Park, Colorado. And so one of the things he still remembered having to do is go to the outhouse. And this is the early 1940s, you know. Uh-huh. So, you know, for him, it was, you know, they still hadn't had centralized plumbing. And he'd have to go downstairs and put wood onto the boiler to get the water boiling and heating the house and all that in the middle of the night. So, I mean, what we think of as certain luxuries, not all of the United States quite had it at that time period.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of hotels didn't have individual bathrooms for every room.
Mm-hmm.
They had hall bathrooms where you had to just take your turn.
Exactly. Now you watch House Hunters and, you know, people complain about not having a dual vanity sink.
I know.
the best 3 o'clock in the morning television watching, let me tell you, when you can't sleep, because that'll just put you right out.
It will.
But so in terms of part of what we think about what America is, and you get the fun of thinking about what America and the United States landmass could have been. And I'm always fascinated with this part of kind of your story, because I often think of your work very similarly to Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, where, you know, Germany took over and won part of World War II, yeah. You know, took over part of the United States. And in this situation, Russia ended up buying California, Washington, and Oregon.
Yes, but with the consent of the Californians. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's important. They had the movie industry in California. William Randolph Hearst lived in California. When the Russian family finally landed on the shore, it was just like a, yes, let's go for it moment. Now we have our own royal family and they're really royal. Pretty exciting.
Exactly. And, you know, and we still have the czars, you know, the czars were not, yeah. in your universe were not horribly murdered the way that we would have expected. And certainly, you know, we've got Peter now, who's, he is persona non grata, but he's still royal, and yeah. Eli, who's still royal. And they're both kind of characters that are willing to be on the outside. Can you give us a little bit of a where they came from, who they are, what was the inspiration?
Well, Eli and Peter are part of the Savarov family. Their father was, I believe, a Grand Duke, if I'm remembering correctly. And they all wandered around on this hopeless flotilla with Tsar Nikolai and his family. And of course, Nicholas did live to get to the United States. Lots of countries wouldn't accept the Russian royal family, including right. England, who turned them down flat. That right. actually happened. So he, in my world, he lived to escape with his family, and they wandered around with a large flotilla of the dispossessed nobility until they finally found a place that would accept them in California. and a place that would revere them as royalty, which they definitely wanted to hold on to. I guess who would not if you were? Exactly. So this whole conglomeration of events came together, and they became the ruling family of the area that used to be California and Oregon.
It's and then you brought in Lizeth within the last couple books. I think it was book three that you introduced her, and then she really becomes her own character fully in book four, is the way I sort of feel like it, with the serpent in heaven. And you know, she's Grigori, so yeah. She's a witch, and we don't really know which, because her father was Grigori, and her mother was a very famous magic user in Mexico. And so we don't really know where her powers come from. She's sort of the time bomb, or the character that we don't know what she's capable of quite yet, but she is quite capable.
Oh, she's quite capable of a lot. The spells that had been holding her in check, put in place by her father, who thought it was much more convenient to have a little child who could steal things rather than a young woman whose virtue he would have to protect and guard, kept her small, mm-hmm. kept her little. And only when she's finally free of his influence and has a place at the Grigori School in San Diego does she start to grow. And she's actually more like 15 than the child she appeared to be. So a lot of changes for her, and a lot of self-discovery. She discovers who the other part of her family really is. She discovers that she has more power than most families ever dream of. And she also has disposed of a lot of her family by the time she realizes they are her family.
Exactly. And, you know, Gunny has had no problem, you know, taking out her own father, but he was a bad man, as it turns out.
He was.
And, you know, unfortunately, so was Lizeth's family. There's a certain level of strength within your female characters that I really, really absolutely love. And both Lizeth and Gunny are incredibly strong women in their own right. And, you know, but without, they also have a certain level of, still a level of emotional vulnerability that I really love within your characters. You know, you really make them three-dimensional. And it seems like, you know, whenever we create our heroes, that we're more likely to create them stronger and braver and without that vulnerability that we're used to. But you don't believe in that with your characters, do you?
I believe that they need to have some chinks in their armor. I don't believe any of us are 100% strong all the time. But I do like to write strong women for obvious reasons. They're really more interesting. Mm-hmm. But I also like to show that people don't necessarily have to be invulnerable to be strong people.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to keep my people, I hate this word, accessible to other people by giving them a relatable, maybe not a weakness, but a vulnerability.
You know, it's funny though, because I think that, and that's maybe a foible that we see in a lot of books. You know, we have, you know, our, you know, we have like Robert Parker. I mean, you've got to believe that Spencer really didn't have a lot of chinks in the armor, so to speak, you know, with his character. And it wasn't until we got into Sonny Randall with some of his problems with drinking and some things that maybe we saw a little bit of vulnerability. But you're willing to really make your characters completely three-dimensional, and you feel like them. Robin stole from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho mentioned that he said so many of your characters feel like extended family, even those other abled. And I love that. I think that he's absolutely right.
Well, that's really reassuring to hear. You have to get so deeply into the characters when you write them. And I always hope that people will read the characters that resonate with them.
Exactly. So, I mean, do you have each series that you've written is very unique. You know, your Aurora Tea Garden series was more of your traditional mystery. This is a little bit more of your traditional Western with a fantasy or an alternative history twist. Do you have favorite series, or do you ever want to go back to any of the series that you've previously written to re-explore the characters now?
I don't like to write the same thing over and over. So usually when I'm through with a series, I'm through with it. Every now and then I'll get a chance to revisit for a couple of books. I did that with Aurora. And it would be nice to do that with Harper Connelly. I would really like to revisit Harper. And the great thing about my Midnight Texas trilogy was that there was a character from every single series I had ever written in that trilogy. And I just had the best time revisiting them and finding out what they were doing.
They all sort of live in your head, and they all take up a little bit of space. And so I'm just wondering, like, if there were times where you're like, you know, I wonder how Harper would do in this, or I wonder how Harper's doing, you know?
I think about them, especially because readers have favorite characters that aren't always characters I think of as crowd pleasers. And they'll say, oh, but what's he doing now? And I'm going, I don't know. Let me think about it. I'll get back with you on that.
Yeah. Who's the one that really surprised you, that really has captured you over all of the characters that you've written that people seem to really miss and want to know what's going on with?
Well, weirdly, Bobo Winthrop from the Lily Bard series. Yes, the Lily Bard series. He's just a side character, and people are just like, what's he doing now? He was so good looking. He had such a hard lot in life. And I'm going, I don't know. Let me look back and see what Bobo's doing now.
Maybe have a short story in one of the, you know, occasional anthologies that we find you propping up in, right?
That would be fun.
Yeah, exactly. To go back and maybe see. Are you working on any anthologies? Because I know that you tend to work on multiple projects at once.
Well, Tony Kellner and I edited the anthologies together for many years, and we had the best time. But like most good projects, it kind of ran its natural course, and we weren't asked to do anymore, which was a pity, because drawing up our guest list was always like Christmas shopping. You know, it's like, do you think so-and-so would do a story for us? Oh, yeah, let's ask her. And when the story started to come in, it was just wonderful. It was just wonderful. But like all projects, it had a natural end. That having been said, there's nobody I'd rather edit with than Tony, who writes now as Lee Perry, because we just get along like a house of fire. And we have very similar taste in work. If there's a story I don't like for some reason, she knows exactly what's wrong and how to fix it. Mm-hmm. And we really helped each other out that way. I think I learned a lot when we were doing our edited series.
It's amazing, because I think with short stories, it's a masterclass in, you know, writing a full story with very limited, you know, space and opportunity. And it's a completely different craft from novel writing, where you get to really extend and flesh out everything. However, I think that your books, you've taken a lot from those short stories and those anthologies to really hone your craft, because I find that, you know, your books aren't 500 pages, and yet you build so much world and you build so much character in a very tight space. There's not a wasted page and there's not a wasted sentence.
I get pretty envious when writers tell me they had to cut 50,000 words from their. I'm going, well, I would have a short story then. I just never have written long. Mm-hmm. I say what I want to say.
Exactly. But everything that you say is so important. And I think a lot of writers could learn from you in terms of world building with you like to show, not tell. And that's part of what I really love about your books. And with All the Dead Shall Weep, boy, I mean, after chapter two, there is not a stop in sight. You do not give us a chance to breathe. How do you feel when you're writing that? Do you feel as intense as the reader does reading your work?
I do. That was like a full tilt boogie book. You know, yeah. You just, there wasn't any place to stop and take a breather without something awful happening. So awful things just kept on happening. It was really a busy, busy book. I just felt like the pace had to be kept up from beginning to end.
I'd be a basket case by the time that I was done writing your book. I mean, because I was just so tense and intent, you know, within your book itself, within this one, that I just, it was really a ride, and it was really an emotional go-getter. I could just imagine just pulling that all out of your head and getting it down there, that you would just be writing this in record time.
I wish I'd written it in record time. I had COVID twice, and it did some things to my brain. And so now I am like the turtle of writers. I just crawl along. And every book, I think maybe this will be the last book I write because I'm so slow, but I'm still working. So we'll see. It would be great if that cleared up a little bit.
You know, I caught COVID. I managed to catch COVID for the first time this year, and it was after I took my mom for her 75th birthday to Las Vegas. Uh-huh. And I said, "Mom, do you want something, or do you want to go somewhere?" And I listed off places, and you know, Phoenix is just 6 hours away. And she's like, "Let's go to Vegas." So we went to Vegas, and we had a great time. We ate some good food, and you know, neither of us had ever been, so it was quite the adventure to go. And I came back 2 days later, and I had COVID, and boy, it took me about a month. And I don't think my brain really, it was in a fog for about a month and a half. So I can completely feel you in terms of how it affected your process. I hear so many people say that.
Well, that's kind of comforting, but at the same time, I'm sorry that other people are having this problem, because for the first time I look at the well and say, is it going to dry up? I mean, have I used all my ideas up? Hopefully not.
I don't think so. I think you've got an awful lot more to say. I mean, out of 40, you know, you've done 40 some books, and I still think that you have a lot in you. Sometimes it just takes a little bit of time for it to refill.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. I mean, I am, you know, old, but hardly. I'm still enjoying what I'm doing. So I hope I get to keep on doing it.
Hardly, you know, and you're so well respected. Kent Kruger was here on last Monday, and he says hello, by the way.
Oh, hey, Kent.
And, you know, Karen Slaughter was here too. And we were talking about your books, and she's a fan as well, and a fellow Southern writer. And you really have a big fan base within the writing community as well. So would you think that, if you get the chance to do an anthology series again, do you pull a lot from like your mystery and fantasy friends to get to write?
Oh, sure. I mean, if you don't ask, you don't get. And that was part of the fun of doing the anthologies, was getting people who had never written a paranormal book or a paranormal short story to write one, to say, oh, I don't know about that. I don't know if I can write a book with a werewolf in it. And I thought, yeah, you can do it. Come on. You can do it. You got it. And to have someone who had written only paranormal write something with an element of mystery in it, that was equally fun to say, look, meet the other genre. You too can do this.
Exactly. And I'm getting a couple of fun questions that are coming through here, talking about kind of your different series. And one was bringing in one of this, Pat Stodge wants to know, she says, wasn't there a father and son? The son was in Midnight, Texas. And so yeah. I missed reading Midnight, Texas. So unfortunately, I don't know much about what's going on in that series. So I'm going to interpret that question however you'd like to interpret it.
Yeah, Quinn the Word Tiger, who was in the Sookie Stackhouse series, appears in Midnight, Texas, and his son is with him, and they were really an interesting pair. And also, this may interest you since you were a fan of Longmire. Longmire was shot in the same town Midnight, Texas was shot in, Las Vegas, New Mexico.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, New Mexico's become a very, pardon me, I want to sneeze.
Well, you just go right ahead.
So, yeah, it's become a very popular place to shoot. And Craig Johnson was saying that when he got the chance to go down there, you know, there is so much of it that looks like the Wild West, and you can shoot there a little bit longer than you can do it up in Wyoming. Yeah. You don't have to deal with as much of the inclement weather that you have to. And unfortunately, Midnight, Texas lasted just a season or two, didn't it?
Two seasons. And I was so sorry. I mean, I've been very fortunate in my adaptation experiences. And I really thought it was so good, and I enjoyed being on the set, and they made me very welcome on the set. But it just didn't last, which was too bad.
It's the transient life of Hollywood, isn't it?
I suppose so. I refuse to believe that it wasn't good, because I really thought it was good.
I thought it was good as well. I watched a few episodes, and unfortunately, I think the time that it was on just never kind of coalesced with me watching the entire series. But, you know, what I liked about it being on standard television was the fact that it was a little bit tamer than True Blood was.
Yeah, it was. And sometimes that was a relief to me too.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, True Blood and the show itself really sort of really popularized Sookie, and still, she's probably still as popular today. I saw an awful lot of Sookie Stackhouse here at the store still. And whenever Hallmark starts showing your Aurora Tea Garden series, we have an immediate bump in people wanting to read that series as well.
Well, that's why we signed those papers, right?
Now, working with Hollywood's a completely different beast. And as a writer, did you ever feel like you were going to have that opportunity? And you know, has it just been a complete learning opportunity for you?
I never thought I would. My whole career has been an immense surprise to me. The adaptations and getting to know a whole different industry. I don't know. Sometimes it was like I was speaking to Martians. Their industry is so different from ours. I mean, writing is an intensely independent, lonely process, and making a television show or movie is intensely collaborative. And they believe they work in the most wonderful industry in the world. Mm-hmm. And that if you have a chance to do an interview that will benefit them, that you will drop everything and fly to Hollywood and do it. And I'm going, no, I can't really do that. I really have a life. So, but that having been said, it was also delightful to meet so many creative people who were so intent on producing something really good.
Exactly. And to trying to really do honor with your writing and say that this is a universe that we like and we respect and we want to bring it out onto the bigger screen. And I think, you know, True Blood was one of the first series that really stayed as close to the books as they possibly could, but they sexified it up a little bit, you know?
Oh yeah, they did, and bloodyfied it up, but that's okay. What makes a good book doesn't make a good television series. I learned that early on.
You can build things out and you can build them slower. However, I don't think that within the Gunny Rose series, you know, you've built anything out slow. You've really, you know, you really exploded starting with An Easy Death, and have kept the books, you know, really, really moving. I don't think that there's really ever been a slow moment in sight, but All the Dead Shall Weep, whew, that's, it's really, it's fun. And we get to learn more about Gunny's mom and Candle.
Yeah, she is a nice woman.
She really is. And I really loved reading any scene that Candle was in, because it was sort of neat to see where kind of Gunny came from. And she's, yeah, she's a little bit of the opposite of Gunny in terms of, you know, she's the school marm.
She is, because that was one of the few professions she could aspire to in her day and age. And then she had the great good fortune to marry someone who has been a fantastic stepfather to Lisbeth. Exactly. And he's just a great stepfather.
He really is. And there was that sort of concern about, you know, Felicia meeting, you know, Candle, and what that was going to be like. And she, you know, she just accepted her with open arms, which was so neat. Kind of the first mother that she ever really had, you know. Yeah. Lisbeth is kind of, I mean, in a way, a mother to Felicia, but, or maybe a grandmother, you know. Uh-huh. Although they're sisters, I mean, so it's sort of a more complicated relationship. A much older sibling can kind of,
yeah,
you know, teach and guide as much as she possibly can. What has been, and where did you base the ideas of magic within this universe? Because most of your characters are very much centered in being able to do things physically, you know, solving crimes and solving situations more with their wits. But you do have a little bit of supernatural intervention. And so I'm sort of curious where you came up with the ideas of the magic system that you used in this book.
That all arose from Rasputin, Gregory Rasputin. I figured in my world, he had kept the Tsarevich alive with magic. And so people were anxious to emulate that as a way of showing solidarity with the royal family and as a way of keeping them alive. So that was how this Grigori system developed. And really, I think magic all comes from the same well. They approach it in different ways. They access it in different ways. But magic is magic, and it's not different kinds of magic. It's just how it's expressed.
Exactly. And we start to see Felicia really get the chance to kind of use it in a way to protect others in this book, which was really neat. So, you know, and her manipulation of the air around, or death magic. I mean, she's a dangerous person in a lot of ways.
She is, especially when you consider she's 15. I mean, that is not a noticeably well-balanced age.
Exactly. She could go to the dark side pretty easily. She could go one way or another.
Yes. But
I think that you've put her in good hands where she won't, because of you know, Lisbeth and Candle and the rest of them now being all part and center of her life.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of excited about that. I want to see where she goes and where she, what happens with her. And as you end the book, and I don't want mean to do any sort of spoilers, but you're leading us into World War II.
Yes.
And a man named Hitler manages to make the last couple of pages
of
the book. And do you feel like his portion of history is going to change absolutely everything within within what is the United States' territories?
Well, it's certainly going to be looming ever closer in the next book, because Hitler was a great magic believer, as I'm sure you know.
Absolutely.
And he is well aware of people who can use magic effectively, and he wants them to be on his side or not to be at all. So,
exactly. And that's why I was wondering how you were going to build that in, because, he had this strong, very strong interest in the occult, you know, and trying to find objects of magical power and ways to, you know, and at the same time, I mean, he built up Germany to be the scientific powerhouse, so to speak.
Yeah.
He was a very strange, it was a very strange dichotomy of beliefs that he had and that he built up. They did some very strange searches for different objects.
Yeah, and that's definitely, when I was thinking about the time period in which the book would be set, it seemed to me that that had to lead into it.
Yeah. Now, do you feel like, I'm curious, what do you look at in terms of the genre with the Gunny Rose series? Do you look at yours as Westerns? Do you look at them as mysteries? Do you look at them as urban fantasies or alternate history? Or do you feel like they're just a story that you want to tell?
I look at them as the story I want to tell. I never have been too fussed about fitting things into small packages. And I really like to write the book I want to write. And luckily, I've had the opportunity to do that for the most part, which is, you know, it's just great.
I love the fact that you're so willing to take risk, and you know, you talk about the fact that your books are stories you want to write, but they're also risky stories in terms of what you want to write.
And publishers don't always want to take a risk.
No, but you're testament to your writing that they're willing to take a risk on your books.
Oh, not all of them.
So, well, you know, I've got to say, you've got so many series. Do you have any dead series that never made it to print?
No. Lucky me, I've been able to find somewhere for everything. You know, but there's always going to be a time when someone says, nope, not going to do it.
But, you know, the funny thing is that, like, it just is testament to your imagination, too. I mean, I love your books. The Gunny Rose series is hard to describe. But once you get it into somebody's hands, they're hooked. They're absolutely hooked.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that. So that's one of the things that, and Robin is asking, you know, please say we're going to see more Gunny Rose. And I think we are.
We are. I'm writing the sixth book now.
Nice. And do you think anything after the sixth book, or do you just go a book at a time?
I just go a book at a time. It could be after the sixth book, I'll feel the urge to write something different. It could be I'll find out my publisher doesn't want any more of the Gunny books, but I'll always find something to write.
Exactly. Well, and what do you do when it comes time to end a series? What is it that you try to do when you put to bed a particular character?
Well, usually I like to leave my main character happy, at least in some way. I mean, it's not always possible to have a happy ending. It's not always possible to even have a half happy ending, but I love these people I write about, and I really want them to end up in a place that seems like will give them a good life.
Has it ever been hard to say goodbye to somebody?
No, I'm always anxious to write the next thing.
And then they can go on. And you know, the nice thing is that we can think about what's going to happen with our characters, but our literary characters are very real to all of us. And on YouTube, I have my sister who she's a huge fan of yours as well. And, you know, she just said that your books are a blessing to her and got her through hard times. And it's really true. I mean, you really grab your readers and really help all of us when we need to escape or we need to feel. I mean, you don't shy away from the hard topics.
I don't. Life doesn't give you that option in real life. So I, as a writer, don't really give you that option in my books.
Is it when you were writing, was it Lily who was the character who was the rape victim?
Uh-huh.
I mean, how hard was that to discuss and to write about? Because that's a very personal and very hard subject to write about, I think. I think that's one of the hardest things you can actually do.
Yep. Well, I myself am a rape survivor, and it was my way of exercising my own demons and yet saying, yeah, this was awful, but look, you can live through it.
Yeah. And nowadays, we're also kind of graced with the idea of having a lot of publishers now have the sensitivity readers, those who kind of read through and kind of look at subjects.
Yeah.
Did you have to do that with any of your books or within the Gunny Rose because of, you know, dealing with slavery or other issues?
I did not, though I wouldn't object to that because I'm well aware that I'm an older American and that some of my attitudes are not current, mm-hmm. which is not good. We always need to be learning and adjusting what we call things. That's very important.
It really is. And it's one of those hard things to do. I think, though, that fantasy itself within the last few years has really become a more inclusive kind of genre, which is sort of neat. We're getting a lot of writers of color. We're getting writers from different backgrounds, and we're getting characters from all over the rainbow, you know, and it's really sort of a refreshing aside. And I look at Gunny Rose as one of those characters that fits really neatly in there because she's a strong, willing to get it done sort of woman. And, you know, I think that, you know, is a very modern approach and a very modern take on a character. But there were women out there who were noisy and not easily put down. What was it that one of my coworkers said? It was something about quiet women rarely make history.
That is so true.
Yeah. So Susan's a character, and she's like, yep. So what is going to happen next after this? You're going to be working on your next book, or have you worked on it?
I've been working on it very, very slowly. And then I'm not really sure what's going to happen next, but whatever it is, I'll enjoy it.
Yeah. Whatever you decide to do and wherever it goes. I would like to ask the audience if they have any questions. I usually get the chance to type it down a little bit before, but unfortunately, I'm bad at doing multiple things at once here, multitasking. Let me just check through here. You know, a lot of people are just really, Midnight Texas is just a fan favorite out of our group here. They absolutely love it. And same with the Sookie Stackhouse. And Somebody wants to know if you've ever thought of writing one that's set during the holidays.
Well, some of the anthologies were centered on the holidays. But as far as, and I wrote one Lily Bard that took place at Christmas, if I'm remembering correctly. You know, usually holidays and I, we leave each other alone.
Gotcha. Not as warm and fuzzy a feeling as for some of them. I think it's a pretty hard subject to write about, and usually they're best in the short stories or the novellas.
Yeah, I agree.
And the other thing that somebody wanted to know is, where did the idea of the were-tiger come from? Was it just your were-tiger?
I don't know. Why not?
Why not? Exactly. We have werewolves, right?
Why not a were-tiger? I think tigers are so incredibly beautiful. And so, you know, their story kind of evolved as a side story, but I really, really enjoyed writing it.
And Robin got my quote, "Well-behaved women rarely make history." Thank you, Robin. I appreciate that.
That is so true.
So in terms of reading, what have you been reading? What have the authors been that have really, or any books that you've just absolutely loved that you need to make a shout out to as well?
I can do that. And that's always on my website. I have a book and blog feature that I talk about the books I've read and enjoyed. I just read an advanced copy of The Court of Shadows by Victor Dixon. He's been published in France for a long time. This is going to be his first book published in America. But he lives in America. He's a super nice guy. I met him in Spain. And believe me, you know from the get-go, and this may sound incredibly naive or something, you know an American did not write that book.
Mm-hmm.
From the choices he makes. And I thought, he makes some very bold choices. And I'm going, you know, how can he get away with that? People don't do that. And I thought, okay, in his books they do. So that was really exciting. And I'm really enjoying Sarah Painter. I love all her Crow Investigations books. I really enjoy those. I read a lot. And I really like to talk about the books I love.
Well, and you know, so many authors love you because I think you really help promote their books as well. And you try
to do it. Glad to do it.
Because I think it's all in the family. You want to let people know what's good out there. That's part of what we love about being booksellers here at the Poison Pen, is we get to talk to people about what's good out there and what's exciting and what's exciting to us. And your book really is just so good and it is so exciting. And I'm excited to sell it, and I think you've done just a wonderful job with it. So Charlene, thank you. I'm sure it's getting late there for you in Texas.
Yep.
So and I know that you're recovering from something, so thank you so much for taking your time today to talk with us about your book and sharing it with us.
Well, I love your store and I was thrilled to be invited. Thank you.
And I can't wait to see you next year.
Oh, I hope so.
we've been doing this for the entire Gutty Rose series. So
that would be great.
To talk to you about that. Fantastic. Charlene, thank you so much. And to our audience, both of us say have a great night. Thank you so much.
Good night, everybody.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.